My name is Matt McCarthy. I'm currently the Vice President of the Black Law Students Association. Thanks again for coming. It really is encouraging to have this great of a turnout. And thanks also to Mayor Brown for their sponsorship of this event. Today's lecture will be the first of four commemorating the 40th anniversary of Thurgood Marshall's appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. While we all know of Marshall as the first Black Supreme Court justice, we hope that this series will spark more in-depth discussion of Marshall's contributions to American law and also of the monumental cases in which he had a part. It's also our hope that you find the series just plain interesting. The series will continue on January 17th with historian Kevin McMahon speaking on how FDR paved the way to Brown v. the Board of Education. And we'll conclude the series in the spring quarter with lectures by Professors David Wilkins and Randall Kennedy, both of Harvard Law School, and both of whom clerked for Marshall as well. Professor Cass Sunstein, speaking today on Marshall's conception of equality, himself clerked for Marshall during the 1979 to 1980 term, and when we told him about the series, he was very enthusiastic and very eager to do the first lecture. We're very grateful that he agreed. With that said, please join me in welcoming Professor Cass Sunstein.
I didn't think about this lecture hard until about 2 days ago, and I think the reason is that when I was clerking for Justice Marshall, this book, The Brethren, came out, which was an expose of the court, and it put a lot of the justices in a very bad light, and Marshall in particular. And Marshall was hurt by it and said to us, you know, I'm not going to adopt any rule. I'm not going to tell you not to talk. But whatever you say is on your conscience. And so I haven't talked at all about the clerkship since then. And a lot of years have passed. Some people don't believe that that's really my picture. And below the head, it's not that different. That was me. And 25 years have passed, so maybe it's time to say something. I also found that this is kind of accompanying me, and I hope you a little bit, in this. This book, which I had thought I'd lost, the library cleaned up my office. You wouldn't notice, but it did. But they put all my books in alphabetical order, and sure enough, this one turned up, which is Simple Justice. And Marshall was not a sentimental person at all. He had a lot of feeling, but sentiment not so much. On the last day, and I remember this so vividly as if it was really yesterday, I came in shyly into his office with this book and said, he called the judge, I didn't mind signing it. And he wrote, to Cass Sunstein, a great lawyer, - to be. I'm prompted to do this, and I think it's not going to violate my conscience, partly because Marshall had, while a pretty small ego for someone so important, he didn't like the fact that Martin Luther King got 99.9% of the attention. And I think the fact that he didn't like that was spurred by one event which he told. When he argued some case before the Supreme Court and won, it was not Brown itself, but it was a huge victory. And he got in the cab the day of the court's announcement, and the cab driver said, didn't know who he was, the cab driver said, do you follow the Supreme Court? And Marshall said, yeah. He said, did you hear about that case today? And Marshall said, yeah, I did. And the guy said, Martin Luther King, the things he does. Marshall also told the story with a mixture of admiration and a little bit of irritation of seeing Martin Luther King on television saying, I'm going to stay in this jail as long as it takes until the relevant city does exactly what it is supposed to do. And if I'm here for weeks, that's fine. If I'm here for months, that's fine. And as Marshall was watching the show, which was a tape of King's speech, the phone rang. Thurgood, Mark, get me out of here. My own experience with Marshall started in law school. I don't know if you all have any of this, but are Marshall's opinions read and focused on? They should be. Marshall, I think the closest thing to Marshall now really is Scalia in an odd way, where Marshall had the clearest, most coherent, most forcefully conceived vision of what the law should be doing. He was frequently in dissent, but even as a dissenter, he exerted a powerful force on the majority. He sometimes, we felt, was moving the court even when the court didn't do what he wanted. And that was the Marshall I knew from law school, not so much from his astounding record of victories before the Supreme Court. He argued, I think, 32 cases and won 29. Chief Justice Roberts has a record of great experience and achievement, but really it's nothing like Marshall in terms of the importance of the cases or the victory. I clerked for a guy named Benjamin Kaplan, who's still alive, on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, who had worked with Marshall in the early desegregation cases. And Justice Kaplan called me into his office and said, you know, Marshall's kind of interested in you. I had a long talk with him. And Kaplan was a bit of a mean guy, so he didn't tell me he said anything good. I suspected that he hadn't. But then the phone rang a few days later, and the secretary said, Justice Marshall's on the phone for you. And he said, three words that came out as one. He said, want a job? And I started gushing, saying, this is the greatest honor, thank you. And he cut me off immediately and said, I don't know what you're so excited about. All you're going to be doing is working on dissents. The clerkship itself, funny how memory works. I remember the first day very well, where Marshall said to all of us, the other justices are great. He said, you're going to like them all. Rehnquist in particular said, I wish he was on my side. But Rehnquist, whose ability and character he thought very well. In terms of the clerkship, I'll tell you three bits that I think are terribly sensitive. I changed Justice Marshall's mind once, only once, in a way that reveals a lot about how he just was. It was a Longshoremen and Harbors Workers Act case, a really boring case, very technical. And the way it proceeded in the chambers is after oral argument, the four of us, four clerks, we'd talk to him about the cases, and one person would have primary responsibility and the other three would chime in. And this case, I thought that a particular view should prevail, and he thought for technical reasons that I was wrong. And as we talked about, I think for 3 hours, which is unusual, because days are only 8 or 9, yes? And so to talk for 3 hours about one pretty technical case was a bit of a surprise, and we really got into it. And I thought the view he was offering, I think I thought it was rigid and formalistic and not consistent with the statute. And the co-clerks agreed with me, but they were scared to say so. And he, in the end, voted with the majority to make a 6-person majority, 6-3. Then the opinion circulated, and we beat that after the opinion circulated. He didn't write the majority or the dissent. To decide what he should ultimately do, we met again. See, does he want to concur? Does he want to offer changes? And you know, what path ought he to take when things got final? And he turned, looked at me, and he said, what should I do? And I said, well, Judge, we talked about this for a long time, and you were with the majority. And he turned to my co-clerks and said, is that what I asked him? And I said, well, I think the dissent is right. And he said, okay, let me look at the papers. So he looked at all the papers in the case, read the briefs all over again, and without saying another word to me, circulated a memorandum saying he'd switched to join the dissent. That was the one time, and it was, I disagree with it plenty, and this was a really trivial case, but both the generosity and the snappiness of the, is that what I asked him, captured a lot when it was like a clerk for him. There are two cases where, two death penalty cases that remain pretty important, where there's a secret story, and here's the story. The one I'm going to tell you, because there was a pretty influential movie a few years back involving a guy whose name I don't know, but who was actually, I don't remember, who was actually central to one of the cases. It was a guy who was on death row for committing a murder, and it turned out the guy was innocent. That's what the movie was about. The guy came within 5 days of being executed before the Supreme Court issued a stay, not on grounds of innocence, but on grounds of a procedural problem. And can you imagine the feeling I had as someone who decades later had worked on that case, just learning that that guy who this movie is about was the person whose execution my boss had prevented, and he was innocent. We had no idea. And here's the background of the case. It was a case in Texas in which the jurors were struck from the jury if they expressed any ambivalence about the death penalty. And as the cert petition read, it just wasn't a great cert petition. And so the court voted to deny certiorari with the two death penalty skeptics, Brennan and Marshall, dissenting from the denial of certiorari as they characteristically did. But Marshall said, there's something going on in this case that the cert petition doesn't really capture. That, if you look at the trial, you see something worse than what the cert petition describes. Get the trial transcript and you read it and I'll read it too. Now, I don't know if from this, from the law school perspective, how unusual this is apparent for a Supreme Court justice actually to read a trial transcript before the certiorari has been granted. That doesn't happen. I would be surprised if it happens once in the following term. And Marshall did it not that infrequently. If we read the trial transcript, and here's what it looked like. The people would get on a voir dire, and the prosecutor would say, do you have any reluctance to give the death penalty? People would say, no. And they'd say, do you have any moral qualms about the death penalty? And he'd say, I don't think so. And then the prosecutor would say, you don't think so? And he said, yeah, I don't think I have any moral qualms about the death penalty, but killing people is a grave act. And then the prosecutor would seize on the case, on that statement, and say, can you swear that the fact, under oath, that the fact that the death penalty is involved would have no impact whatsoever on your judgments in this case? And if a juror said, I can't swear it'll have no impact, they were excluded from the jury. That is pretty extreme stuff, isn't it? Because a significant number of Americans who were fine with the death penalty can't swear under oath in this formal proceeding that it will have no impact on their judgment. The prosecutor in Texas got rid of all those people, which meant you had a, sometimes called a death qualified jury, a bunch of people who had no reservations whatsoever, and that would not be the conscience of the community. Okay, once we saw that, Marshall said, why don't you write that up as our dissent from the denial of certiorari, and just put the transcript out. I think I have that, the dissent from the denial, someplace in my basement. I think I kept it. But it was never published. And the reason it was never published is once the court saw what actually happened, it unanimously granted certiorari and reversed the death sentence of this guy who turned out to be innocent. So that had systemic effects, at least for a while, and maybe to this day, on death sentencing in Texas. But there was another one where the clerks could not possibly have done it on our own. It had a similar feature. There was a cert petition in which there was a doctor who was saying that the person who was going to be executed was had psychopathic personality and would kill again. Psychopathic not in the sense of mental ill, but in the sense of just murderous, and would kill again. And Marshall, this is another Marshall thought from reading the cert petition, it wasn't any good, and the court voted not to grant cert. on this one too. There's something going on in this case which is not captured by the case. And my co-clerk, who now has the record, I'm proud to say, for the most billable hours by anyone at Sullivan and Cromwell. Very hard and read hundreds of pages of testimony, but he didn't pick up anything. It looked like the doctor was, he was good. The testimony was good. It was credible. What kind of legal issue could there be if there was no lawyer present at the time that the interview with the doctor took place? And that was the legal issue in the case. The doctor finds it's great. Marshall read it. He said, "This isn't what it seems to be. This lawyer is saying this by rote. This doctor is saying this by rote. This isn't based on an individual judgment about a particular defendant. I know what you can about the doctor." So we found out what we could about the doctor, which is his name informally was Dr. Death. And on the basis of 10-minute interviews, dozens and possibly hundreds of criminal defendants, he said exactly the same thing over and over again, and juries believed this and put people to death accordingly. Here, the dissent from the denial of certiorari was also produced. It's also never been come to light because the court, once it saw, thought this is utterly unacceptable and found it a Sixth Amendment, as I recall, a Sixth Amendment violation. Okay, what I think you can get a little bit from this is Marshall's attentiveness to reality and facts in a way that unprecedented, I think, in the court's history. He was a trial lawyer, and he was an amazing trial lawyer. And this was kind of shot through his work on the Supreme Court and often pushed his colleagues in pretty invisible ways. In terms of the clerkship experience, a lot of it really was talking to him and hearing stories from him. Sometimes the stories were, the connection to the case was palpable. Sometimes it was more something like educational and fun to hear the stories. And he knew Truman, he knew Kennedy, he knew Roosevelt a little bit, he knew Johnson very well. And he had a lot to say about all of them. He loved Jack Kennedy, he hated Bobby Kennedy. Said when Bobby, you talked to Bobby Kennedy about something, and Bobby Kennedy kept saying, "You people, you people." Stunning. This was about black people. And you people are asking for too much. Even people are demanding too much. Marshall said, "Then what have I ever asked you for?" Which is a quite characteristic of him. He hated his pretense, and he hated people who thought they were superior. When he met Prince Philip said in a snotty English accent, "Do you care to hear what I think of lawyers?" Marshall responded, "Do you care to hear what I think of princes?" And they actually became good friends. I was able to dig up three stories that Marshall actually told us. And so I'll give you a flavor of them this way. I had an innocent man once. He was accused of raping a white woman. The government told me if he would plead guilty, he'd only get life. I said I couldn't make that decision. I'd have to ask my client. So I told him that if he pleaded guilty, he wouldn't get the death sentence. He said, "Plead guilty to what?" I said, "Plead guilty to rape." He said, "Raping that woman? You gotta be kidding. I won't do it." That's when I knew I had an innocent man. When the judge sent the jurors out, he told them that they had three choices: not guilty, guilty, or guilty with mercy. You understand those are the three different possible choices, he instructed. But after the jury left, the judge told the people in the courtroom that they were not to move before the bailiff took the defendant away. I said, "What happened to not guilty?" The judge looked at me and said, "Are you kidding?" Just like that. And he was the judge. Marshall then, as he told the story to us, said, "End of story. The guy was found guilty and sentenced to death. But he never raped that woman. Oh, well." Okay. Now, what I cannot capture, this is a gruesome story, isn't it? But as Marshall told it, much of it was funny. I'm not sure how to think about that. Okay, story number two. Did I ever tell you about the welcome I received in Mississippi? It was early evening in a small town in Mississippi in the 1940s, and I was starving, he said. So I decided to go over to the restaurant, see if one of the cooks would let me in the back to buy a sandwich. You know, that's how we did things then. The front door was so inconvenient. As he described it, Marshall then said, a white man holding a gun sidled up. Boy, he said, what are you doing in these parts? I said, I'm waiting to catch the next train. He said, listen up, boy, because I'm only going to tell you this once. The last train through here is at 4 p.m., and you better be on it, because you're kind of ain't welcome in these parts after dark. Guess what, Marshall said, I was on that train. The third one is the most grueling, because this ought to be widely known. There should be a movie about Marshall. He was almost killed, actually, about a decade before Brown against Board of Education. So he came very close to being lynched. And the circumstances of the near lynching in the 40s were in Oklahoma. It was a bit of a surprise. While he was doing the early desegregation cases, there were about 25 people were accused of some capital offense in Oklahoma that was ridiculous. It was clear this was not, this was made up, and they were going to be executed when even a conviction was unsupported by the facts. And Marshall had no time. He was doing the desegregation cases, but he went to Oklahoma. He got the 23 first ones off, group of 23 off, pretty easily. And then he came back again for the two harder ones. He got the 24th off, and he got the 25th limited sentence, 5-year sentence. But then as he's going back, this is the story, a mob's following him. And these are his words. The mob followed me out across Duck River. The mob was a very interesting mob. It was composed equally of state troopers and city police. They said they had a warrant to search our car. I said, go ahead, looking for liquor or something to arrest him. It was a dry county. And they looked through, didn't find anything. Police officers said, go ahead, and then we drove about a mile and they pulled us over again. Then I heard a voice in the back say, that's the one, the tall one. So they took me out toward the river and told Luby, who was the driver of the car, and the other guys to keep going the other way. Luby wouldn't go the other way. He was one brave man. He followed them as they carried me down toward the river. When you got down to the river, you could see the people there for the party. By party, I mean lynch party. But Luby and the others wouldn't leave, so the officers didn't know what to do. So we drove back into Columbia, and the head guy of the group accosting us, the head of the city police, whose name was Lynch, I thought that was a good name, said to me, you go across the street and you see that sign that says Justice of the Peace, you go across there and I'll be over there behind you. I said, I'm only going to go over there if you come walking right with me. Why, the cop said. I said, I'm not going to go over there so that you can shoot me in the back and claim that I was escaping. That's too easy. You come with me. So I went over there where there was this little magistrate, a very short guy, 5'2" at the most. The magistrate said, what's this guy charged with? The officer said, drunk driving. The magistrate said, look, I'm a teetotaler, never had a drink in my life. I have my own private test. If you take that, I'll decide your guilt or innocence. What's your test, I asked. Blow your breath in my face. So I blew my breath, and the magistrate rocked a little bit and looked at the cop and said, you're crazy. This man hasn't even had a drink. He's certainly not drunk. Okay, what's Marshall doing with these stories? The capital punishment, the death penalty one, had a lot to do with the possibility of error in the domain of capital punishment. Had a big impact on Justice O'Connor in particular, trying to guard against procedural unfairness or error. The other two have to do with encounters with the criminal justice system, where what appears to the justices might not be reality. And this, Okay, there are people who are attuned on the fourth in some way to some of what Marshall cared about, but their life experience and what they focus on is just a fundamentally different pole from his. Those who admire him most on the court, maybe Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer, they're law professors whose experiences and law practice are so far afield. Okay, I want to say a little bit about what Marshall enjoyed and what Marshall cared about. Think about something about a person. Think of what did they like. And what he enjoyed, really, was banter. So when he talked to us, I don't know if you know anyone like this. There was never anyone like Marshall. But what he enjoyed was banter. And if we got into it a little bit, he liked it. I was scared of him, because he was considered Marshall. But I did make him dissolve in hysterics once. There was some lawyer in some case who was Bernstein or something, and he was talking about this well-known lawyer named Bernstein. And he turned and he said, "You know Bernstein? You know him personally?" I said, "Judge, I don't know all Jews." He quite liked that. also liked it a lot when which was not fun, but which hit him deep in his core, when something he cared about legally won. So let me say a little bit about what he cared about legally. A little insight from this from our own Professor Hutchinson, who knew Justice Marshall a bit, and who had uncovered in, I think, Warren's files, an early draft of Brown against Board of Education, which emphasized much more than Brown itself the centrality of education to the outcome of the case, saying that this was an education case in large part where people were being deprived of equal educational opportunity. And Marshall was delighted by that. He said, "That's it. That's what the case was about." So if we look at what animated Marshall's jurisprudence substantively, and here too, I would really like it if the youngish, middle-aged Marshall were on the court at the same time as Kerr and the ever-young Scalia. Very nice to see them go at it. Marshall's conception of the Constitution and of equality had three components. There was education or equal opportunity generally, which permeates his Supreme Court decisions. There's what might be called an anti-caste principle as a conception of equality. I've written about this, and I got it from him. The notion that the Equal Protection Clause is best understood as an attack on second-class citizenship. That's what it's about. And most innovatively, Marshall, I think, was prepared to understand the Constitution to create an equality right to freedom from desperate conditions. Let me say a little bit about three things. Marshall's greatest and most characteristic opinion, in my view, is his dissenting opinion in the school financing case. The school financing case involved tremendous disparities in how much money was being spent per pupil. And the question was, is this constitutionally acceptable when some kids get a lot of money and resources from the taxpayers live in one place and other kids get a tiny bit? And he said, the court said, no, it's not unacceptable because there's no discrimination against any identifiable group and there's no right that's fundamental. And what Marshall said was, you are misconceiving the notion of our equal protection jurisprudence, which doesn't go on-off switch with respect to groups and rights, but involves more attention to the nature of the right and its connection to constitutionally specified rights and the nature of the group and their relationship to constitutionally protected groups. And he spoke at some length about education and its clear nexus to citizenship and in particular freedom of speech, saying that uneducated people can't benefit from the free speech guarantee and therefore education does have a constitutional place. Justice Powell, another kind of private story, who wrote the majority opinion, which is a good one, was kind of bowled over by Marshall's dissent, meaning it was very powerful legally and technically, as well as having the rhetoric is very hard not to get carried away by combination with the technical arguments. And Powell, I think, at that point became, even though this was like a very pitched battle between the two at their best, Powell became a great admirer of Marshall. And maybe I'll tell you one little other inside story, which is we would often put papers on Marshall's desk. And the week after The Brethren came out, as I put something on his desk, there was a note there from Powell. And I can't read this. And I didn't read it, but I did read the last sentence, which was clearly about The Brethren. And it said, "Your place in history is secure." So I kind of formed an attachment over that. Education, any case involving education was a big deal for Marshall, and he spoke of a right to an equal start in life as something he thought was constitutionally founded. I'll say a little bit about method in a moment. Okay, in terms of the anti-caste principle, this is, he wouldn't use a term like that. He'd find it too academic and annoying. But the idea of the Equal Protection Clause, as he understood it, was that no group of people may be systematically subordinated on the basis of some characteristic which is over which they have no control, with limits, or that an end that is morally irrelevant. So his notion of equality was not egalitarian. He was often accused of being an egalitarian, nothing like that. But he thought if you have a group of people who on the basis of one characteristic is placed systematically below another, that's what the Equal Protection Clause is designed to stop. After Brown against Board of Education was decided, he said, "Aren't you going too fast, Mr. Marshall?" This is before the justice trying to desegregate the schools. And he said, he gave a revealing answer. He said, "The Emancipation Proclamation was nearly 100 years ago. I'm a gradualist." And the link between the Emancipation Proclamation and school segregation, you could see it was immediate in his mind. Which is why Marshall was the first one on the court and the most passionate one on the court, and I think still the most determined and clear one on the court to say that the Constitution has something to do with discrimination or subordination on the basis of disability. Maybe the only one on the court who's saying that. So in a case called Cleburne, Marshall signaled a path not taken, which was to do something in the domain of disability that has been done in the domain of sex equality. Seeing discrimination on the basis of disability or ordinary practices that turn the morally irrelevant difference of physical or mental handicap into a systematic source of subordination. Marshall insisted on that. No other justice has, I don't think. This also helps explain what is more publicly salient, maybe in connection with Marshall, which is his bafflement at the constitutional attack on affirmative action, which was not at all embarrassed or hesitating. The idea was that affirmative action programs are designed to overcome a legacy of subordination and to see them as in the same category as what he spent his life fighting against is a cruel joke. So if you look at his Bakke dissent, the last paragraph is pure Marshall. I'm sure a clerk had nothing to do with that. The last paragraph is about the arc of history, where there was slavery, and then it was gotten rid of, and then the court gutted the provisions getting rid of it, and there were various practices, Jim Crow, and now there's an effort to do something to overcome a legacy of subordination, and now we've come full circle, where the court is asserting itself in order to prevent measures which are plausibly connected with overcoming subordination. This isn't to say that he loved all affirmative action programs in principle. It's just he thought that the notion that they're in the same category as American-style apartheid and picked up by the same principle seemed to him really incredible that the court had done that. The most innovative of Marshall's constitutional opinions, I think, are in the area of poverty, health, housing, food. You can see pieces of Marshall's jurisprudence, and they have to be assembled, like puzzle pieces that are Split Apart, in which people are getting not enough to eat and feed their families because of some rule in the welfare program that is rigid. And he says, if the rule is rigid, making it so people in large families are getting ridiculously little money on which to live, the state had better come up with a plausible justification for that. Rational basis review itself isn't enough if we're talking about something as central to existence as well as citizenship as that. Cases involving people losing their homes because they can't pay for them, he wants to make sure the rules are procedurally fair. In cases involving deprivation of welfare benefits generally, he insisted on procedural fairness. But I think he was willing to go further if the court had developed this way, as the South African court has, in order to at least spark something like recognition of the constitutional right to be free from desperate conditions. That's a bit of a stretch from what he said when he was getting there. So when we think of Marshall's conception of equality as a justice, at the heart of it is education as a constitutionally protected interest, the notion of discrimination being understood as a ban on systematic practice of subordination, and as a plea for something like a right to freedom from desperate conditions. Some of these remarks are spontaneous, because when you have an experience as powerful as that, it bubbles up. There's only one case that made Marshall really mad, Mike, only one. And that was a case called City of Mobile against Bolden, which is a voting case in which the court narrowly construed the Constitution to, like his lights, to permit forms of subordination of African-American voters that could not be shown to be intentionally subordinate. They were practices. Maybe you could speculate that was the intention. You couldn't prove that it had an effect. And Marshall, look at his dissent in City of Mobile against Bolden. He told my co-clerk, go after him on this one. And this is not like, not often like him. He was willing to be tough. But here he thought this was really the heart of what the Constitution was about. As I said, I think a lot about what his relationship would be to the current situation and to the current court. One little signal of free association is that when Marshall died, there was this great celebration at Arlington National Cemetery, a celebration of his life, mourning of his death. And it was all formal, and there were prayers and everything. His family was there. And it didn't capture him or his impact. The next day, he was his casket lay in Washington, D.C. It was bitter cold, and 20,000 people lined the streets of Washington to go up and see him. And there were notes to him and notes to his family. Pardon me, and he choked up. And someone put in a yellow slip opinion, you know, the Supreme Court issues the day after the decision to defend against the Board of Education. I think Marshall would be very surprised to see the current court in the sense that a vision or presence like his is quite absent. He did get into it with Scalia. I think I have a sense of what he'd say. He had a tremendous lawyer, Marshall. And the scuttlebutt when I was in law school was that Marshall was the person who had the clearest and most powerful vision on the court. But Brennan was the technician of the Warren Court. When I was there, at least, it was exactly the opposite, in the sense that Brennan was like the guy with a vision that he would bring to bear in every case. But Marshall was the technician. So when the two of them, and you could see them walking, Brennan was really small, and Marshall was huge, they could see them walking together, they were clearly friends. But Marshall was the real lawyer, not Brennan so much. I think what Marshall would say to Justice Scalia is that the way our system works best, and what's produced the results we have are not to stick with the original understanding of the Constitution narrowly conceived. The idea that we ought to do that needs a defense, not an exclamation point. And if we look at the system of rights which we have, it's come from a different method. So why don't we try that? That's what the debate would look like. And Justice Breyer, for all his ability and eloquence, he, I think, is Justice Scalia's principal opponent on these issues, hasn't said anything quite like that. Okay, I have three quotations from Marshall to give you. The first, just by serendipity, I found the text out from the last time I saw Marshall at a clerk's reunion. I'll tell you a little bit about him, I think. This is, Marshall knew a lot of people in his life in terms of importance and numbers. And while he was extremely warm and engaged with his clerks, he wasn't that personal with them. He cared about them a lot, but he didn't show it much. I think there was an essential shyness in him. So I remember when I went back and saw him a few times after I clerked, and came into his chambers and sat down. And I thought the first time, which was about a year after, do you remember me? I had lost a lot of hair. And he was so great. And he said, and he didn't use our names much when we were clerks. He called us all knucklehead. We all had the same name. He'd say, hi, Cass, how are you? And we talked about Chicago, and he was a big fan of Chicago. The last time I saw him was at a clerk's reunion. And at the clerk's reunion, he was shy and didn't like being celebrated. But he stood for the clerk's reunion. He committed them. And at the last one, he actually gave a speech, which was stunning. He didn't do that sort of thing. And here's what he said, just about verbatim. The goal of a true democracy like ours, explained simply, is that anyone born in these United States, even if he is born to the most illiterate, blackest, most underprivileged family in Mississippi, is merely by being born and drawing his first breath in this democracy, endowed with the exact same rights as a child born to a Rockefeller. Of course it's not true. Of course it never will be true. But I challenge anybody to tell me that it isn't the type of goal we should try to get to just as fast as we can. Some of the last words I heard him speak. The last words he spoke to the country, really. And he did, he was the Supreme Court Justice, he was kind of silenced. So I'll tell you, I'm about to tell you, by way of conclusion, the only major public statement he made while a Supreme Court Justice, which caused a furor. But after he retired, he was over 84 years old, he's on Independence Day. And I think this is what he'd say were he here now, both to lawyers and to citizens, and maybe particularly to lawyers. I see a nation not of unity, but of division. The legal system can force open doors and sometimes even knock down walls. 84, mind you, wheelchair bound. We will only attain freedom if we learn to appreciate what is different and muster the courage to discover what is fundamentally the same. Take a chance, won't you? Okay, the last thing I'm going to tell you about Marshall is on the bicentennial of the United States Constitution. When there were celebrations of the miracle in Philadelphia and the wisdom and genius of the founding fathers and their prescience and how, if we can recover them, we'll get it constitutionally and socially. Marshall was made very uncomfortable by that. So unlike Justice Breyer and Justice Scalia, sometimes Justice Ginsburg, sometimes Justice Kennedy, who speak publicly about issues, Marshall just never did. But this was his exception. He said, with respect to the celebration, I cannot accept this invitation to celebrate the founding, for I do not believe that the meaning of the Constitution was forever fixed at Philadelphia. nor do I find the wisdom, foresight, and sense of justice exhibited by the framers particularly profound. To the contrary, the government they devised was defective from the start, requiring several amendments, a civil war, and momentous social transformation to attain the system of constitutional government and its respect for individual freedom and human rights that we hold as fundamental today. When contemporary Americans cite the Constitution, they invoke a concept that is vastly different from what the framers barely began to construct two centuries ago. If we seek instead an understanding of the Constitution's inherent defects and its promising evolution through 200 years of history, the celebration of the miracle of Philadelphia will, in my view, be a much more meaningful and more humbling experience. We will see that the true miracle was not the birth of the Constitution, but its life, a life nurtured through two turbulent centuries of our own making, and a life embodying much good fortune that was not. Thus, in this bicentennial year, we may not all participate in the festivities with flag-waving fervor. Some of us may more quietly commemorate the suffering, struggle, and sacrifice that has triumphed over much of what was wrong with the original document, and observe the anniversary with hopes not realized and promises not fulfilled. I plan to celebrate the bicentennial of the Constitution as a living document, including the Bill of Rights and other amendments protecting individual freedoms and human rights. Marshall didn't produce all of what he wanted. In some ways, he died, I think, frustrated and uncertain. But it is true that the Constitution under which we now live is, in large part, his.
We have the room for just a few more minutes, so we can take one or two questions.
Professor Sunstein, the story you told about, that Marshall told about lynching and et cetera, he obviously didn't take the dangers faced by African-American lightly, but in the stories you told, it kind of appears that he did. Is that a result of kind of cynicism of years of fighting these cases? What do you attribute that to?
It's a great question. That the stories, which had such ugliness in them, he laughed at the end. Or there was humor in the telling. I really can't understand how it worked or why he did it that way. One that was kind of a nice one for his all-white law clerks that year to hear was, it was about whether race discrimination was faced by only poor African Americans, or he was alert to this with respect to sex equality and other forms of discrimination too. Gay rights, by the way, was something he was in the forefront of. And what he said was, you know, I've been all around the country, and there's no place I've been when I had to look at my hands to figure out if I'm black. Meaning, he was treated differently in every part of the country. He found it funny. It was a kick in it that was both a kick in the pants and a joke. So you ask, what was going on there? It was his optimism, really. I think he would have a refusal to take the bitter stories as all bitter, rather than a little bit of a kick to the people who were listening, but also a sense that this isn't something to be defeated by. This is something, in a way, to be laughed at. So I don't know if I've captured it all, but so many of his stories, the brutality behind them, but the humor with which he told them. I mean, it's very interesting to think if each of us in our own life, without whatever struggles we face, can or would like to have this. I don't think it's because he was old. I think that's how he always was. Another story he told, I don't know if I'm going to get this completely right, but when he was a young man, he was a waiter, and there was some very important rich guy who called him all over and by the N-word. And he was waiting, and he kept being demeaned in this way. He also got huge tips. And the boss at the restaurant said, after hearing all this, said, "What's the name of that guy calling you?" And Marshall said, "Boy," which was tolerable in that time. And he wouldn't disclose it. And his father heard about this. And Marshall explained to him what was going on. And then Marshall, as he told the story, not to his clerks, but to others when he was a younger man, said, "And you can call me the N-word all you want, but as soon as you run out of those 20s, I'm going to smack you in the nose." I'm not sure what he's doing exactly with that story, but I think the reason he had such an effect on O'Connor and others, really, Powell, people who you wouldn't think, was that the stories captured something about what life was and to some extent is still like, which they hadn't seen. And then it's hard to, I just gave you two examples of the death cases, but there are plenty where both the outcome and the reasoning was affected. So I guess I think, when I think his conception of the Constitution was very optimistic. It was, while he died, didn't like Justice Thomas at all. I mean, personally, who knows, but he didn't like the view or the history of the view. But he thought that history had a very good arc, and that that like his story about Rockefeller. So I think there was a refusal to be defeated or bitter. He was never bitter. There were stories that could produce bitterness, but there's a kind of kick to them.
All right. Once again, everybody, Professor Sensen.